I want to welcome you to Housing Works Bookstore Cafe. We're really excited for this event tonight. But before I get started, I just want to tell you a little bit about Housing Works for those who might not have ever been here before. Housing Works is a not-for-profit bookstore. Everything we sell has been donated, and everybody who works here is pretty much a volunteer. Everything we sell and all the proceeds here go towards Housing Works, which is our parent organization. It's the U.S.'s largest minority-controlled AIDS service organization, and they do a whole host of vital services for men, women, and children with HIV and AIDS. So we hope you'll support us here tonight. All of the books that we have for sale have been generously donated by the publisher, so we hope you'll relax, enjoy our cafe, buy some coffee. If you have any donations of books, CDs, or records that you want to donate, you can come anytime during store hours and drop those off. And if you're interested in volunteering, we'd love to have you. We just ask for about 4 hours a week, and you can ask anybody up front about that. So we are really excited tonight to have William Gass here. It's sort of a launch for the audio version of The Tunnel. Unfortunately, the audiobooks are not ready yet, but we do have the books here for sale. And I'm going to do just a little quick bio for each of our participants, and then I'm going to turn it over. We're going to start playing some of the tracks from the audiobook. William Gass is an essayist, novelist, literary critic. He was born in Fargo, North Dakota. Gass introduced audiences to his polished, energetic prose with the 1966 novel Omensetter's Luck and the classic book of short stories In the Heart of the Heart of the Country. Two essay collections earned National Book Critics Circle Awards for criticism, and in 1995, Gass completed his monumental novel, The Tunnel. One of contemporary literature's most important writers, he has been the recipient of numerous awards and grants. Lauren Cuoco is a former NPR reporter based in St. Louis, where, with William Gass, she founded the International Writers' Center. She's the editor of 6 books published by the IWC, including The Writer in Politics, The Writer and Religion, The Dual Muse, and The Literary St. Louis, A Guide. Let's welcome them.
Anaxagoras said, "To a man who was grieving because he lay dying in a foreign land, the descent to hell is the same from every place." The Tunnel. What I have to tell you is as long as life, but I shall run as swiftly, so before you know it, we shall both be over. Life in a chair. It was my intention, when I began, to write an introduction to my work on the Germans. Though its thick folders lie beside me now, I know I cannot. Endings instead possess me, all ways out. Embarrassed, I'm compelled to smile. I was going to extend my sympathy to my opponents. Here, in my introduction, raised above me like an arch of triumph, I meant to place a wreath upon myself. But each time I turned my pen to the task, it turned aside to strike me. As I look at the pages of my manuscript, or stare at the books which wall my study, I realize I must again attempt to put this prison of my life in language. It should have been a simple ceremony, a wreath to honor death and my success, the defense of my hypothesis concerning Germany. And when I wrote my book, to whom was I writing, if not the world? The world. The world. The world is William welching on a bet. It is Olive sewing up the gut of a goose. It is Reynolds raping Rosie on the frat house stair. It is a low blow, a dreary afternoon, an exclamation of disgust. And when I wrote, was I writing to win renown, as it's customarily claimed, or to gain revenge after a long bide of time and tight rein of temper? To earn promotion? To rise above the rest like a loosed balloon? Or was it from weak self-esteem, from pure funk, out of a distant childhood fear or recent shame? The world, alas. It is Alice committing her Tampax to the trash. I began, I remember, because I felt I had to. I'd reached that modest height in my career, that gentle rise from which I could coast out of gear to a soft stop. Now I wonder, why not? Why not? But then duty drove me forward like a soldier. I said it was time for the big book, the long monument to my mind I repeatedly dreamed I had to have. A pyramid, a column tall enough to satisfy the sky.
You've heard the beginning of the 45-hour tunnel audiobook about the first 4 minutes or so. I have no reason not to believe that this is historic and that it is unabridged and read by the author. I'm sure that in time this too will become de rigueur, along with all the nonfiction works that have become audiobooks read by the author, that Jim Dale will get no employment after this. I don't mind Jeremy Irons reading Lolita at all, but I would have liked to hear Nabokov read it in full. Whatever its historicity, it is done, and it is long, and it is a first among many firsts Bill Gass has managed. It traversed a spring and a summer in 45 sessions. For your amusement, at the end of the program, we will play the outtakes, a special treat for the audience, as it will not be available in the MP3 version. I'm going to tell you a little bit about the process before I query Bill on a few things about the audiobook and then about the big Hermann Göring Fat novel that engendered it. We made the recording at Clayton Studios, the premier professional studio in St. Louis, which had not quite attempted such a thing before. Commercials, music, technical narrations, other voiceover work, these are the usual things produced there. When I heard that it was a go, I called Dick Hewlett, a longtime radio guy in St. Louis and proprietor of the studio, and said we had this project. I had no idea how long it would take, what sort of editing would be involved, or even if it was going to be distributed. Could have ended up entirely a vanity in 45 CDs. Before our first recording session on April 11th, Bill and I met for lunch to go over the beginning of the book, how he would pronounce things, how he would deal with the typographical oddities, guess at how many pages we'd get through. We thought, well, maybe we could get it done in a month if we worked every weekday afternoon. We finished on August 24th, recording usually three times a week in order to give Bill's voice a rest. What I want particularly to tell you is that our engineer was a self-proclaimed gearhead from Granite City. That's across the river and into Illinois, where I grew up, by the name of Keith, highly competent, but who mainly produces commercials. The first day we get Bill set up in the booth with his microphone and his hardback copy. Keith has a copy. I'm next to Keith with my copy in the control room, and Bill begins to read. We get through 14 pages. Bill leaves, and I sit through the edits to make sure that the ones I noted are the ones that get made. And then later, as this will be my last chance to do so, proof the CD copy at home that night. During the editing, Keith wants to know if it's true. The book, is it true? So I try to explain to him that some of it could be true, but that his wife is not fat, not blonde. He has 5 kids, not 2. He taught philosophy, not history. And no, there is no money in writing, at least not the kind that Bill does. But even so, during the course of recording this 652-page novel, the gearhead from Granite City would give out gasps at some of the passages that Bill would read. They were so breathtaking. And he fell in love with Bill, as everyone does, and his voice so much that he wants him to do voice work, which bruised my ego about as much as I think Bill likes his vermouth waved around at a gin. So I'm going to begin the interview by asking Bill to talk about breath as it relates to your writing and your reading aloud. We'll talk about the really big breath later. Bill, you've said that in your long years of teaching that your breath lasts about an hour. Rather remarkably to me, that was about the breath of each session. I know that you hated the stops and starts that are natural to anyone doing a recording, even prose. He didn't believe me about this. But the novel actually divided pretty well in this way. And the tracks, as one will read them in the booklet, will reflect this. Did you change your ideas about your breath as we made our way through the tunnel?
No, I think, of course, there's breath and breath. When I said that, I was talking about how long a particular piece of prose would tend to go before finding some sort of emotional conclusion. And I discovered, to my chagrin and surprise, that it was the length of a lecture, probably 50 minutes to be precise, when the students start to scramble out of the classroom. I don't know whether it was the long years of teaching that had anything to do with it, but I noted that essay projects, as well as parts of longer books, would tend to fall into about 25-page chunks, which, if read in the right kind of type and so forth, runs around 50 to minutes to an hour. And so I always thought of it then as my breath, meaning I'd have to then stop and really think about the next inhalation, so to speak. I think that was a measure of the meaning unfolding breath, if you like. It took, of course, it's always been interesting to me that poetry, when read, for instance, is created out of our used up breath. It rides out on carbon dioxide. That's always been sort of interesting to me, that we form the very stuff we're getting rid of, which led to other images, of course. But I think that that's one of the things that had to do with the breath, in the sense of using up what you've taken in and thought about, and then we're unreeling or unbreathing in your writing. I don't think I changed my mind. I was holding my breath during most of the reading, however. I was scared to death.
I know that Bill will claim that he screwed up a lot, but the fact is that given the density of the prose, his mistakes were proportionately few. The engineer was as amazed as I was. In fact, I could show you page-long paragraphs where he made no mistakes at all. There's no edit marks at all, which I think also says something else about your writing. But anyway, it must have been hard reading some of the sections because you never thought that you would have to do that out loud.
Yes, that's true. I did, of course, publish pieces of the tunnel over the 30 years it took to finish the book, so that the world, the small world that I occupy, would know I was still alive. But and I then would also read pieces of it at various readings around the country. So I had read some parts of it, and some parts of it several times. I also had mouthed, if you like, every page many times because that's the way I work. That is, sitting at a typewriter, which is what I was working on when I started, or at the computer, I mumble the words as I'm doing them, except that the curses I usually leave out. And this kind of process that I was engaged in, it had a very tiring effect on me as I hit passages which I had just mumbled maybe dozens of times as I was composing them, but had never dared to voice them. One of the good things about reading, maybe the only thing I can think of readings, is that while you're reading a new piece of work, you sometimes feel a reluctance to do the next paragraph, and you know that maybe it's not what it should be. And then you read it, and you know it's not what it should be, and you get a chance to change it. But this was all too late. So there it was. Paul Valéry once said that every bad sentence that you write trails behind you like a monster. And I certainly concurred many times during it indicts you. It shows you for the rotten writer you are. And that kind of constant reminder, which is what writing is partly anyway, was a part of the reading.
You started it in 1966, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Finished it in 1995. We recorded in 2005. You've talked about the reading of it, but was there something else you discovered aside from whatever the quality of the writing you think it was reading through it? But was there something about its sound, its music, its rhythm that was new to you?
Well, I didn't think that my writing was like eating steak, but it was very chewy. And when I was reading it, many passages, I could feel, you know, the movement around of the sounds and how you have to move your mouth. I always wanted that, but I didn't want to have to do it. So it was. It's a very chewy manuscript, I'm afraid.
It is. Are there parts now that you've read out loud that you would be inclined to read in public that you wouldn't have before?
No, I don't think so. I actually, many of the things I read in public, I will never read in public again. I was rid of that book when I sent it off to the publisher and we finally got it in print. But now I'm really rid of it. I was thoroughly sick and tired of the whole thing.
Before each session, Bill and I would go into this little room at the studio to go over the day's pages. In preparation, I would consult the dictionary a lot, lots of dictionaries, very old dictionaries, foreign language ones, encyclopedias, very old encyclopedias, other books, which is one of the best things about working on this project. And contrary to Kohler, I love Bill's dictionary phase. However, because of my former career in radio, I know that in front of a microphone, a word you thought was yours might run away on little fairy feet. So you better look it up if you have any doubt at all, because it will look like a foreign language to you. I also learned in my other career a lot about a little about a lot of languages. But even so, pronunciations can change over 40 years in a living language and some dead ones too. How Bill says something might not be the way I would say something. For example, datum, datum, suke, weni, weedy, weeky, which I don't think is in the book, but shows the difference between church Latin and classical Latin. So we had to agree on how he was going to say it, even if it was wrong. That is, if it was, I couldn't find it in the dictionary. And of course, Bill coins a lot of words, and he even coins coinages. But anyway, Bill's German pronunciation is better than my French. My French is better than his German. But still, we had to be in sync about it, because the fewer stops for pickup edits, the better for Bill, for me, and for the engineer and editor. And for those of you who've read the book, you know that there's a lot of talking and thinking about sex in it. Even though Bill and I have been cussing freely in front of one another for about 15 years, I did blush when I had to correct him for reasons of continuity on his pronunciation of pubes. Mm-hmm. Talk back button, Bill, it's pubes. Unless you want to say poobs, in which case you have to say it that way throughout the whole of the book. And every time he got to pubes, he'd say poobs. So, and when I say that the novel is unabridged, I lie. There are certain things that could not be conveyed, and it's not just the illustrations that Bill made. All the illustrations in the book are by Bill. But the other things, like lines that would march off the end of the page and things like that. So one more anecdote before we talk about the novel proper. This is from page 242, Accusations of Platys Helminthism. This, of course, would send most of us to the dictionary, even those who know Platys Helminths or even Helminths. I believe Bill coined the philosophical movement of it. My method on a tough word is to say it three times, but for Bill, it's better if he doesn't worry it. He says how he's going to say it. I repeat it for good measure. So we're in the recording studio, and when he comes to this title, it's about halfway through the recording. So he comes to Accusations of Platys Helminthism, and he nails it. And when Keith, the engineer, finally puts the brakes on his brain, he asks me what Platys Helminthism is, and Bill's nearing the bottom of the page with no screw-ups. And when he does eventually make a mistake, which happens, Keith said where we should stop to do the pickup edit. And he says, back to Accusations. And I'm laughing so hard when I hit the talk back button that I couldn't talk. And Bill's response is one of the highlights of the outtakes that you'll hear at the end of the program. I have interviewed Bill formally once in 1985 about the publication of Habitations of the Word. I have informally interviewed him thousands of times during our years on the board of River Styx, our time at the International Writers' Center, and now on this project. I have not interviewed Bill about the tunnel. What I have had are many seminars on it before we went into the studio, when Bill would review what he was after, where he might have failed in his own estimation. So I'm going to ask now what I asked once during the recording about the novel, which is, how did you know when you were done?
Well, I knew I was done when I reached the last sentence, which I had written 10 or 15 years earlier. So it was like getting to Chicago. There was a sign that said, you are entering Chicago. But of course, that just dodges the question. That is, the question was how to get to that sentence properly, and then you would be, in a sense, done. And that was not so easy, and it took years. The final year in which I worked on this book, I wrote half of it. So you can see that it took a long time, and then suddenly I knew that that sentence was waiting there. It was unfortunate, because I remembered all the great sentences that finish a lot of great novels. Particularly, of course, is the Ulysses, and there's the ending I like best almost in George Eliot's Middlemarch, triumph, wonderful ending. And mine wasn't sufficiently, trumpeted and beautiful. But there it was, nevertheless, waiting like a ditch. And so I, would finally stumble up to it. But I had it. I mean, the ending was done, in a sense, long before I reached it.
One of the things that's included in the audiobook, and by the way, this is a mock-up of the packaging for it. This is a low-res thing that we just got done in time to come here. And in the finished project will be a booklet. It'll look like this. And in it is something Bill's never published before, which is called The 12 Philippics, which I call a précis of the novel, but that's been used for what you'll find in your context at the page when Bill signs books later, which has actually Bill's specifications for the type used for the novel. And Bill makes up all of these typefaces, and it's wonderful, so be sure to pick that up. But Bill, if you would please talk about when you wrote the Philippics and why.
Well, when I first had scheduled the publication of this book, it was not with a publisher who I have now, Knopf. It was with another publisher, and the editor there and I were having certain difficulties about his understanding what in the world was happening and why, and so I tried to inform him about the way the book was put together. He had a desire to make it much shorter by taking out pieces, and I was trying to show him that the building would fall down, that it was built a certain way, and so on, and that it had certain tones. I knew, too, that the tone of the book is that of old orators. So the word Philippic, the attacks by Cicero and so on, or Cicero, some might say, I don't know, but were appropriate. It was also that the book was built on Schoenberg's 12-tone system. This is a metaphor which I'm not going to bore you with, but the book was arranged in 12 sections, and then there were sections in each 12, but the idea was that each of the 12 sections would develop one of the basic 12 themes of the book, and that theme would dominate that section. But all the other sections would be there, but in different orders of representation, different levels of emphasis, so that we were going to have each section a combination of the 12 chapters' themes, but at different rates, and rising and falling and so on and so forth. And so I wrote this also to indicate what was going on in those sections and what was being stressed and why and so on. I had belabored the book with structure after structure, really. It was overstructured because it kept like very slow-moving molasses. It was seeping away in every direction all the time. And it was necessary for something to be put in there to capture it and keep it in line. And so I kept adding things as I went along. But the Schoenberg idea, just as a kind of metaphor, was there from the beginning, along with the controlling metaphor of the book, which is the tunnel itself, so that the tunnel had to be an emptiness, because that's what tunnels are. It had to be a pile of dirt, because that's what you take out in order to make the tunnel. And it had to be a structure. If you're escaping from a camp, you might use bedboards. I always like that. And to keep the thing up. And I had a lot of bedboards trying to keep this thing up. But it was also, of course, had to resemble a pile of dirt. I think I did that better than anything else. So I was trying to explain all of this so that he would leave the text alone.
Well, the other thing that, aside from the 12 philippics with essentially the section titles for the novel, there's also a description of the cast, the structure of the book, shadow themes, levels of organization, and things like that. And those are all in the booklet that will be in the final edition of it. Did you get a sense when you were reading the novel this time around that you were encountering another self?
No, I don't think so. I thought I was encountering another novel, though. It wasn't the one I remembered. You have those experiences all the time, of course. While you're working on the book, it's one kind of thing. And, of course, it changed a lot because of the time it took me to decide what in the world I was doing. And then when it's printed, you know, out in actual print, everything looks different. It just doesn't look right at all. Who did this? You all have had the experience, I think, of looking at a word, and perfectly familiar one, and suddenly not recognizing it for a moment. The whole book looked like that. Now, doing it this way, the book just changed. And wasn't what I had thought it was at all. So, that was the news. All the news was tended to be bad.
All right, time for another cut. This is from a section called Why Windows Are Important to Me. And it's an example of the mixed up elements of this anti-novel that Bill has mixed for us. And it should begin with, I once went to bed with a nun.
I once went to bed with a nun who put her hair up in a bun. Not the hair on her head, no. She shaved that all off, so tee-dum, tee-dee-dum, tee-dee-dum. A sawbuck for any last line that beats mine, Culp crows. I worked through sunset into silence. Chapter on ideology. Funny cartoons from Der Stürmer. Fascinating remarks by Mr. Rosenberg. Free silver. The spread of the pox. Shire's curious reading of Mein Kampf. Racism as a Hebrew notion. Political motives of the Emancipation Proclamation. Fascinating remarks by Mr. Rosenberg. Chamberlain, Nordau, and Gabineau. The Red Revolt in the Armies. Hitler's philosophical genius. Mutterrecht. Cézanne's little sensation. Fascinating remarks by Mr. Rosenberg. The Birch in English Education. Lou Andreas Salomé's Not Sleeping with Andreas. The Artois Trip to Russia. Fascinating remarks by Mr. Rosenberg. Lenin at Yasnaya Polyana, where Rilke meets Tolstoy, is not invited to lunch, and Prussian militarism is overstated. Asian influences in higher education. Grinspan's crime. Wilson's women. Degas and Celine. Fantasia of the unconscious. Fascinating remarks by Mr. Rosenberg. Spengler as a closet optimist. George von Schoenherer anticipates the Führer. Hygiene. The shock of circumcision. Rose's monument. Harding's weakness. The Dawes plan. Jung's defection. Fascinating remarks by Mr. Rosenberg. Fichte, Schelling, and Heidegger. The goose step misnamed. Kristall knocked. Leopold Putsch anticipates the Führer. Madness and masturbation. Lou Salomé's Not Sleeping with Nietzsche. Not Sleeping with Freud either. Fascinating remarks by Mr. Rosenberg. Chesterton's Degeneracy, Schopenhauer on Silence, riots of joy at the first appearance of Der Scherer. Fascinating account by Mr. Rosenberg. The Chevalier Raoul, Rousseau, Several Shades of Shirt, Kant's Clock, The Convert, The Covert Fascism of the Bloomsbury Group, Irish Marching Songs, Giovanni Gentile, and Social Credit, Cunnilingus, The Vienna Circle, Fagin, Fascinating Remarks by Mr. Rosenberg, Pound of Flesh, Ezra Pound, Eliot, Yeats, Honesty of Anti-Semitism, Roosevelt, Not the God of the Jews, as sometimes alleged, Fellatio, Hugo's Huge Ego, Maupassant's Satyriasis, Archbishop Laud, The Wreck of the Deutschland, Patriotism of de Sade, Last Chance to Unify Europe Lost, Lincoln as Leader, Zola's Murder, Mozart's Murder, The French Overrun Paris, Culp, The Meter Maid, Herschel as History, Fascinating Remarks by Mr. Rosenberg, Window Shopping along the Kurfürstendamm. Culp, Forefinger Up, has an important announcement to make concerning his limerical history of the human race, that is to say, the triumphant completion of Chapter 1864, the Geneva Convention. The heads of all the great powers, after talking for hours and hours, were finally able, their guns on the table, to reach an agreement on prisoner treatment and the cost of small funeral flowers.
That's an analytical table of contents of the tunnel.
And presumably, that would have occurred earlier than page 289?
Yes, but of course the book doesn't start for 100 pages. A tunnel, escaping tunnels have hidden entrances. And so you first have to hide the entrance so no one will know where it is. It's usually under the John, but you have to wait a while.
So the analytic table of contents for William Kohler's Guilt and Innocence in Hitler's Germany. So that would have been the table of contents for that book.
Okay. Yeah.
Which occurs on page 289. When you did finally complete the novel in 1995, not the audiobook recording, you were at the Getty. This was the first year of our IWC life. Did you think, as Stanley Elkin said he did after finishing George Mills, that you owned the language?
Oh, no. No, I had no such dreams. Sometimes I think the language owns me. But it's a constant struggle. And I could never say I had any command of things. Too much revisions, too much starting over, too much confusion while one's working. So it never... I felt very little, in fact, when I finished the book, except, that's over, you know.
And how old were you when your mother baked that cake?
She never couldn't bake.
Well, one...
Things get made up in fiction.
Well, one reviewer who read the book said you were age 12.
Oh, well, which, that was clever of him.
But as I read the book, your age was very specifically not given, the age.
No, there's no age for the character.
Right. So there were other places where I was duped, having read the book and then listened to it. So just for my own curiosity, I'm going to ask a couple of questions if you don't mind trying to answer them. When you said that Kohler inherited Magus Tabor's chair, I read that as literally physically.
Yeah. He bought the swivel chair that Magus Tabor, his previous professor in Germany, whom he admired immensely and was his mentor, sort of. And he bought the chair. And
so does it surprise you that somebody confused that with actually inheriting his department chair?
Or was that was supposed to be a part of the meaning. Kohler takes the chair because that's what he wants, is Magus Tabor's chair, and all he gets is Magus Tabor's chair. And he is pissed off because there was a chair in his own department and he didn't get it. He also, of course, wants to pun on chair, which means flesh or in French.
About the naming of the son, the one son who's not named. I read one reviewer also interpreted this in a way that I didn't when I read it, and you say you specifically never utter the name, but you give us clues as to what it is, so that you say she named him after me.
Mm-hmm.
And then you talk about writing the A.
Mm-hmm.
So I never picked up on that he might have been named Adolf.
Yes. He left his wife the task of naming the child, and his wife, who was thoroughly annoyed with him by this time, named the kid Adolf. And he never spoke the child's name.
And was it number one or number two son?
It was the number two son.
Right.
On the other hand, of course, you can't believe a word the narrator says. I mean, he is a liar, but it's hard to know when he's lying and when he isn't. He says he describes how he's digging a tunnel from his own basement. Everybody wants to believe that can, if they want to. I wanted to take the narrator you couldn't trust to the nth. He lives in a strange world, so maybe he did have five kids. He just isn't telling us that.
Well, I have to say, in the parts of the book that I love are little Billy Kohler, and I would like to think that some of that really is about you, because, I'd buy your kitty car at auction.
Yeah.
So I think we should play the outtakes now.
They have always coveted possessions, their sons, their sheep, their soil, their silver. Stop having a good time. You do that one. What would I do with a duck? You fuck a duck, dummy, we said then. Well, I wouldn't fuck a duck, even if, I had to fuck Miss Duck. The rigmarole went on. This is a creative moment, you know. Didn't I say that? Oh. I wouldn't fuck a duck. I got it. Yes, I see. See, I missed this great change here. I don't want to do it again. I've had enough of it. Then someone threw a piece of board, which went thwack. No, it didn't. It went thack. Or one could say, Jesus, we're only halfway. Yes, it's going so well. If it gets any worse, we'll just burn the book, or me, I don't know which. Yeah, sure. Yeah. Well, that's because we have our genius of a fudger around here to change everything. Meanwhile, Mommy is off with other mommies, self-congratulating themselves for having wombs and making their bodies more pud-abundant by the minute. My mother withdrew the skin to suds my butt. But that too. The pillow willows. The pillow. pillow wows. The pillow willow wows. There are more names for them in this book than in any other. Yes, I've counted them elsewhere. The buying power of the penny changes, I mischievously continued. God damn it. Blame it on Keith. As if they'd caught a cyclone in a sack, the whole works rises. I could keep my class in line and not have to lift a finger, raise my voice, form a frown, merely by promising to turn them over to Odilo Globochik. Who the hell is that? No. Merely by promising to turn them over to Odilo Globochnik, to have an entrefest at their expense. No, it's earntefest. This is too much at one time. A kind of savior for the ephemeral, for tie clasps and pencil stubs, report cards and date books. These critics, you know, are everywhere. The shit said, I was worried it was your mother, said the shit. To think I'd given him those lucky strikes. The shit bred goog. There's a pun in there. Shall we try it over? Okay. The shit bred goon fuck. Stick around, I said. She goes next. And did. And how in the that's hard to make unless you're just sort of incompetent. You say Reiner, and I say Rainer. But there isn't much which, on the whole, unrecommends it. That doesn't make any sense.
There you have it. We're going to step down from the stage and chat with anybody who'd like to talk with us near the cafe. And Bill would be happy to sign books. And you can pick up the context. And thank you all for coming very much.